Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Mike Murphy. On today's edition, host Richard Tripp talks with Jill Dalton, founder and editor of Evolving Magazine, about what it takes to get a publication started. Then, in the second half of our broadcast, we replay an interview Margot Patterson did in 2014 with Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center about hate crimes, what they are, and why they exist. Well, we won't have a calendar of events this week, but do stay tuned for the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Up next is Richard and his guest, Jill Dalton, but first, these messages.
Hi, I'm Michael Hogue. Monday on the Arts Magazine Show, originally developed through a workshop with Casey Rep and the Living Room Theater, it's a rock and theater fusion which revolves around a drug-fueled trailer park in Stillwater, Oklahoma. It's called Stillwater, and we'll talk about it Monday at noon on the Arts Magazine Show.
Dr. Margie Kerr is a small-town gal who grew up to become known as the sociologist who studies fear. Tune in to the chilling adventures of Dr. Margie Kerr on Sprouts Thursday at noon.
Good morning, Kansas City. This is Richard Tripp on Jaws of Justice. Today I got a real treat for you. I've got Jill Dalton, the founding editor of the Evolving Magazine. Jill, are you there?
Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
Good morning.
People are wondering why I would bring somebody with a holistic magazine on the air. And it's simple. You see, all of us, I don't care if you're in jail, if you got a mental problem, we all need changes in our life. And we all, every once in a while, look to see where we can make that change, if there's a better way of doing things, if there's a better medical way of doing things, like diabetes. And so that's why I brought you on, to tell a little bit about how you've done what you do.
Wonderful.
Let's start with what made you start Evolving Magazine?
Oh, wow. Well, back in 1994, and it actually led back earlier than that, in 1990, when my father passed away, it was this catalyst to a lot of changes in my life. I didn't have a real firm belief system in place at that time. And so when my father passed away, I started searching because I needed to know that there was more to life than this. And so I started going to a counselor and journaling and reading self-help books. It was a real powerful period of self-exploration for me. While I was reading the self-help books, I would skim them just to get the meat, you know, the heart of what the topic was. And I kept wishing at the time that there was a magazine where we could read about all these things, you know, like journaling and self-exploration, spirituality, holistic health and wellness, that were all put together in one publication. So while I was 29 and I was a non-traditional student at the University of Kansas at the time studying journalism, and so I started the magazine Evolving Woman while I was there and published it for 6 years.
When you came back to Evolving Magazine in 2009, what had changed?
Well, when I first started Evolving Woman, there wasn't really anything like it at the time. People would kind of crinkle their nose and say, "Reiki, what the heck is that?" You know, and it wasn't just common practice. And practitioners, you know, living their passion and their purpose, they weren't coming and doing that as much as they are now. You know, it wasn't as often that you would hear someone say, you know, "I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to go be a Reiki practitioner or a massage therapist or an aromatherapist." And so when I came back in 2009 with Evolving Magazine, they were. And people are, you know, receptive to it and there's more education about it. So when I published the 6 years of Evolving Woman, it was kind of a time of educating the public. And you know, I would get phone calls all the time and emails from people saying, "I've been waiting for this. You know, I've never heard of this. You know, I'm so excited to learn more." And so when I came back with Evolving Magazine in 2009, the timing was just perfect.
Well, you know, we all need a mission in life. What's your mission? I mean, what's your passion in doing what you do?
Oh, wow.
I figured I'd get you with that one.
You would, because it's a biggie for me. I'm very passionate, and my passion and my mission are kind of two separate things, but yet they blend together. I have this incessant need to create things, and so after 12 years of publishing the magazine, I still get the greatest joy from picking up a copy. Like, I pretend like I've never seen it, and I get a cup of tea, and I sit down, and I read it like it's the first time. And for me, and I'm tearing up even thinking about it, because it's still... It is just pure joy creating something, you know, from just an idea. And the magazine itself has such vital energy, and the readers pick up on that, and they respond to it as well. So it's kind of like the magazine is a friend. And while my passion is to create, my mission is to share other people's stories, because there's such power in sharing our stories and from learning from each other and what we've gone through. You know, because I like to joke in the beginning and say, well, I don't know anything about anything. You know, I'm just sharing other people's information so that I can learn along with the reader. But whatever the topic was that I was exploring at the time, that's what the reader explored. So it was kind of, they were sharing my path with me, you know, my personal journey of self-awareness. And one of my good friends used to joke and say, Evolving Woman is by Jill for Jill. And in a sense, she was correct, because I'm not an expert on any one topic, but I am blessed to be able to have the ability to give the readers access to those who are experts in their fields. And I so believe in the power of sharing our stories and learning from each other, and Evolving Magazine is a conduit for that learning.
Right. And, you know, tell people your website. I think it's important people get the website.
Yes, please. We just had it redesigned because we started a new magazine in Santa Fe, New Mexico this month, and so it's completely redone with just oodles and oodles of articles, and it's a very great resource and for people to go. And if they can't pick up a copy near them, they can go online and read every issue there as well. So it's www.evolvingmagazine.com.
Yeah, well, I went to that site, and I checked it out, and I was really surprised at all the information. I mean, it is loaded with all types of information on just about everything.
Great.
And I'm looking here. What's the Conscious Living Festival you're connected with?
Well, we started a festival last year, and so for... 13 months over the past year and a half, I had a center in Shawnee, and we called it the Conscious Living Center, the Evolving Magazine Conscious Living Center, and it was a way for the readers to experientially live the topics that they'd read about. So the writers of the magazine would come in and put on workshops, and people would get to just, you know, come and experience those topics. We also had the artists who would create the cover art. We'd have them come, and they'd show their artwork, you know, on the walls. We'd have an artist reception, and it was just this fantastic year of community and fun. Well, while we were there, I started something called the Evolving Magazine Conscious Living Festival, and it was last year was the first one, and the center where we were at was situated on over 3 acres, so we had events going on indoors and out all day. The festival had 6 bands. We had workshops every half hour. There was food, demonstrations like yoga and Qigong, and we had over 40 holistic practitioners and vendors there to show, you know, what it is that they do and to educate people. Other than the wind blowing over a few tents, it was a glorious day, a very windy day, but it was a wonderful day. And now this year, because we don't have the center anymore, we're looking to partner with Uptown Theater. And so on August 22nd, we'll have the festival again this year. It'll be the Evolving Uptown Green Fest, and it'll be from 10 to 5 to August 22nd. So we're really looking forward to that.
You know, I've read over your magazine, and I've talked to you in person. And, you know, over the last year or so, you've really had a lot of changes. You want to tell us about some of them?
Oh, my gosh. You know, when you open yourself up to something, it's amazing what all happens. You know, when the lease was up at the center last November, I was at this turning point, and you know, we didn't renew the lease because the building had been sold, and so I had to make some decisions about what I was going to do with my life personally as well as professionally. And I had worked nearly nonstop the previous 12 months with doing the magazine, freelance writing, and putting on different events and workshops, and it was probably one of the best years of my life as far as meeting the community and getting to interact, but it was exhausting. I was working day and night and weekends and all the time. And so when we didn't renew the lease, I suddenly had this opening of time. And so I looked at my life, and I realized I didn't have any real ties that were keeping me from traveling, something I hadn't done since I was a kid, you know, late teens. And, you know, my kids are grown. I didn't have the center anymore, wasn't dating anyone, didn't have a pet any longer, you know, just all these things that normally tie you and keep you responsible, you know, in that sense. And so I realized I could do a lot of my work on the road. And so I decided to explore the United States by train. And so to do this, I sold, I gave away and donated most of my possessions, and I downsized my life considerably. Moved into a tiny house in the country where it's quiet and centering, and I have a feeling of, you know, that feeling of having less is actually empowering. And so because we have so much stuff that it's like almost exhaling when you let it go. And by releasing so many things, I made space literally and figuratively for more in my life. And that space is definitely filled up this year. My plan originally was to take 1 to 2 week trips by train, using it as my office and then exploring different areas. And I've always been fascinated by our differences. My mom and I, we spent 3 months backpacking through Europe when I was a teenager. And that really kind of instilled in me that, that desire and that curiosity about other cultures. And so I took off on the first leg of my train trip in January 5th. And my first stop was Santa Fe, New Mexico. If anyone's interested, I started a blog, and I'm also writing a book about my train travel experiences called, and it's going to be Wanderlust, One Woman's Journey of the USA by Rail. So back to this whole past year. So there have just been many wonderful, yet frightening, but yet life-enhancing at the same time changes, and they're still going on, so I'm very grateful.
Our readers are... or our listeners are interested, where could they pick up a copy of your magazine?
Well, we're distributed throughout the Kansas City area, 250 different locations, plus at events and things all month. You can go online, and if you go to the resource tab, it has distribution. You can put in your zip code and find the closest place. Or if they just, you know, usually libraries are a great place to start, Whole Foods and Overland Park, you know, we're all over the place, coffee houses and tea shops.
Well, I noticed from going to your site that you have two very important directories. One is the holistic directory, and the other is the wellness directory.
Yes.
And I'm amazed at all the people you have on there.
It's fantastic, and that's kind of what I was talking about when I just said it's just, you know, exploded as far as people being able to live their passions and to do these types of practices. But yeah, we've got two different directories. One is a print one, the wellness directory that you were talking about. It's our annual wellness directory, and it comes out each March, and it's loaded. I mean, like maybe 100 practitioners are in there, and we pass it out all year round at different events, and it's also online to where people can read it there. And then we just started a few months ago this holistic online directory. And that's an online resource where you can go and you can find, you know, look up a category and find someone near you. And it comes up with the Google map, you know, so that you can find someone close to you that practices a particular thing. So you can, you know, look it up and find it there.
Okay, let's push your website again.
EvolvingMagazine.com.
Okay. I understand you also have a book out.
Yes, I do. it's been a while. You threw me there. It's The Joyous Journey, Living Life with on Purpose with Purpose. And it was really a compilation of, I used to write occasionally for the Kansas City Star's Simplify Your Life department. And so it was some of those pieces as well as some of my previous publisher's letters, and it really just kind of, you know, I explained a little bit in 94 when I started the magazine, I was really deeply into self-exploration. And so it was almost like my journal in print, basically, I guess. It was just myself going through these periods of life and what I learned from it. So, yeah, that's that book. It's been a while.
Well, you know, you're like me. You're in a little bit of everything. I know you do writing workshops, too, on the side. Where you get all the time?
I know. I wonder that myself, too. But, you know, like I said, when I got rid of my things and I also quit smoking after 30-some years, and that freed up a considerable amount of time. And I never, you know, just really, it's been almost 6 months now, and so I've been exploring addiction and this and the habit and the time that it takes consuming your mind. And so I really believe that's one of the biggest things that freed up my time. And even though it seems like such a small thing to give you time, it really has freed up. It's freed up my mind and my time to be able to write more and to travel and do the magazines.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm sure a lot of your readers and a lot of people listening, every once in a while, they have things they'd like to write about and send you. How would they do that?
Oh, sure. If they go onto the website, evolvingmagazine.com, there's a section that has the writer's guidelines, and it'll outline, you know, the best way to approach it. Each month, the articles are based on whatever the theme is. So they'll go look at the themes and see one that might be appropriate for them, and then send me an email with an idea. We do work several months in advance. We've booked, you know, the majority of this year. But, you know, someone look at the themes because they'll be pretty similar again the next year. So just take a look and send me an email.
So what do you see in Jill Dalton, pardon me, Jill Dalton's future?
Oh, my gosh. Well, right now I'm living my future as far as the travel. You know, I really am enjoying this time of taking the train and traveling around the United States. And what happened was when I went to my first trip in Santa Fe, I wound up finding someone who wanted to publish an edition of the magazine there. And so it kind of sidetracked my train travels just for now because I...
Hello? Hello. We lost Jill for a minute. Let me get back with you. KKFI.
Hi, this is Jill.
Okay.
My call dropped.
Sorry, I don't know. We dropped you for some reason.
Yeah, I apologize. I don't know what happened. But you want me to just continue where I was?
Yeah, continue.
Okay. When I went to Santa Fe in January, I was not looking to start a new magazine. I was, you know, doing the first leg of this travel experience that I wanted to do. And I got to Santa Fe, and I had, you know, for years I had thought about branching into other cities with the magazine, and I thought I wanted to do it one city at a time and take it nationally. And so I went ahead and put an ad before I got to Santa Fe, not really expecting any replies. And when I got there, a man named Devin Jackson contacted me, and I honestly told him at first, I said, you know, Santa Fe is a spiritual mecca. There's no way there aren't just a ton of magazines like this. And he assured me that there weren't and that they were desperate for its own spiritual publication. And he was right, and the response has been phenomenal. So we started that with the May issue. We just came out with the Santa Fe edition of Evolving Magazine. So it's a very exciting time branching into there. And if anyone's interested, you know, they can read those articles online as well. But back to your question of the future. So I'm planning, you know, I've been in Santa Fe now for this week three times this year. And so the next branch of my train travel trip in July, I'm looking to go to the Southeast. And then in the fall, probably September, go to Oregon and Washington. So it's very exciting. And, you know, a lot of fun plans coming up.
Well, don't forget, I'm starting a paper here in Kansas City, and I can always use your knowledge in order to do that.
Oh, for sure. I'm happy to help.
I really don't know what's next for me either.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that the Trip newspaper will start for the homeless and the poor here in Kansas City. And what we're going to do, we're going to try to make the public aware of all the property in our town and how to take care of it. In order to do that, I need newspaper people.
Right.
Ex-newspaper people that have volunteered in the past at places that want to make a difference in our community. So I'm just throwing that plug in for myself because, you know, we plan on having the best poverty newspaper in the Midwest. I mean, we've never had one here. You got them in Denver and New Orleans and all over, but we ain't got one here. Well, I'm getting ready to make sure that changes.
Well, I'm impressed and I'm proud because it takes a lot of work and it takes a real strong, moral system and values and ethics to create something like that. So, Richard, that's I'm awed.
Well,
and I'll help you.
You know, a lot of people look at me and they say, "Wait a minute, Tripp. You're a ninth grade dropout. You can't do that kind of stuff." And I say, wait a minute. I got God with me. If you got God with you, you can do anything.
That's right. That's exactly right. When I started the magazine, I had zero experience.
Well, you know, in the past when I started COP, my organization, Care of Poor People, they said, you're just a ninth grade dropout living under the Broadway Bridge. Ain't nothing you can do to make change in this city. Well, after, 30 years, they don't say that anymore. As a matter of fact, they call me a lot of names. But you know what? That's life. I can dig it. I'm a big guy.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it has really been nice talking to you. And one more time, plug your website.
EvolvingMagazine.com.
And, folks,
August 22nd will be our festival. And at the Uptown Theater from 10 to 5.
Okay, I'll be there.
Wonderful. It'll be great seeing you again, Richard.
Okay, folks, you've been listening to Jill Dalton, the founder, editor of Evolving Magazine. One heck of a nice lady. So with that, let me let you go. This is Richard Tripp, Care of Poor People on Jaws of Justice.
Glenn Greenwald.
A society that is susceptible to being watched at all times is a society that will be conformist and compliant and obedient. And that's the reason why every tyrant loves surveillance, because it keeps people in line.
On Why Privacy Matters, Alternative Radio, Wednesday, 9 a.m.
Let us be together, let's pretend that we are free. Let's so be where the angels find us, we all have the key. Shall we seal the truth of life? Shall we light the heavens? We're so good at finding pleasure as to what we are and how we fit together. Let us sing the song it is, let the sound of all belief. Let's all find that space in life to follow in between. It's something that I feel far upon my soul, countenance of love for one and all. To know there's so many force of nature prevails. I lay down and I pray. Let's get our hearts together, and as before and like before, we'll do again. To know there's so many ways, the force of nature prevails. I lay down and I pray. Let's get our hearts together as before and like before. We'll do again.
This week, religious outsiders.
They may need more time to partake in sacraments. They may need different concessions to participate as fully as possible. Mm.
We talk to people of faith who often don't feel welcome in their houses of worship. I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right before the Jazz Disciple.
Danny Cox and Rosie's Bar and Grill in a benefit concert for the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. Saturday, May 16th at 7:30 p.m., All Souls Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. People in the Kansas City area were shocked when in April a gunman shot and killed two people at the Jewish Community Center and another at the nearby Village Shalom Retirement Home in Overland Park, Kansas. The suspected killer, Frazier Glenn Miller, now facing trial for the murders, has a long history of involvement in extremist causes, was said to have shouted Heil Hitler when he was arrested, and was at one time the Grand Dragon of the Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan before being sued by the Southern Poverty Law Center for using intimidation tactics against African Americans and for forming an illegal paramilitary organization. The Southern Poverty Law Center monitors hate groups and domestic terrorism, and here today to talk about hate crimes legislation, and other activities of the center is Mark Potok, a senior fellow there. Mark Potok, welcome.
A pleasure to be here, Margo. Thanks for having me.
Going to the Southern Poverty Law Center's website, I was surprised by the range of hate groups that your center identifies and follows. The center lists anti-immigrant groups, black separatist groups, white supremacists, neo-Nazis, anti-government patriot groups, and others. How does the center decide what is a hate group? Is it a group's actions or their statements that you look at?
No, hate groups are simply about the ideology of the group. In other words, does the group say that an entire group of human beings, based on their class characteristics, is somehow less? We have some language on our website where we list these groups, where we say all hate groups have beliefs or practices that attack or malign an entire class of people, typically for their immutable characteristics. So in other words, if you say or your leader says, all white people are blue-eyed devils, all black people are criminal, all the Jews are whatever it may be, it's those kinds of statements that cause us to list these groups.
Who are the most common victims of hate crimes?
Well, in terms of frequency per capita, there's no question at all, based on quite a bit of work we've done here, that it is in fact the LGBT community. I think probably within that, transgender people are the most attacked. But that's very clear. They're attacked at something in terms of hate crimes, not just all kinds of violence, but in terms of hate crimes, at something like twice the rate of black Americans, four times the rate of Muslims and Jews, and it goes on from there.
What's the prevalence of hate crimes, and what are the most common hate crimes committed?
Well, it's an interesting question, because the FBI National Hate Crime Statistics have shown, since they began publishing these numbers back in 1992, annual totals of something around 6,000 to around 10,000 a year nationally, depending on the year, and the number kind of bounces up and down. All of us in the field thought that those numbers were low, but of course that was not provable for a long time. However, in the last several years, something called the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is a unit within the Department of Justice, has done three major and very important studies. And while the methodology is fairly complicated, the upshot is that the real number of hate crimes in America is almost 260,000 a year, which is remarkable. In other words, it's something like 25 to 45 times higher than the national FBI statistics suggest.
And what are some of the crimes that would be committed? I mean, what would the spectrum be?
Well, what hate crimes really are not a freestanding class of crimes that aren't like any others. In most states, hate crime laws are simply penalty enhancements. They come in the sentencing phase of other crimes. So you might be charged with aggravated battery or assault or murder or vandalism, say, of a synagogue or whatever it may be. Typically, under these statutes, say you would normally get maybe, say, 5 years for aggravated assault. If it's charged as a hate crime and if the jury agrees, that sentence might double or even in some cases triple. It's not usually that much high, but the sentence gets longer if the crime is found to be motivated by hatred of a particular group.
So if I asked you what the most common hate crime committed would be, it would really just be what the most common crime is?
That's right. I'm not sure I know absolutely the answer, but I'm sure that it's various kinds of assault, all the way from simple assault to aggravated battery.
I'm wondering if you could bring us up to date about the case of Frazier Glenn Miller. At the time he was arrested, it was reported that he would likely be charged with a federal hate crime on top of the murder charge he faces. Do you know if that's going forward, and what would the reasoning be, since if he was convicted of murder, he'd go to jail for the rest of his life, possibly face the death penalty? What's the rationale for then prosecuting him on a hate crime charge?
Well, I don't think he is being prosecuted on hate crime charges. He is being prosecuted on murder and capital murder. And, you really made the point in your question. If you're being tried for capital murder and you're convicted, there's not much people can do to you that's worse than putting you in the executioner's chamber. So very often those kinds of things, there's really no point in charging it as a hate crime. There is a point for some people. Sometimes the victims in the community or the families of the victims very much want these things prosecuted as hate crimes just to make it clear to the world what was really at work in the murder or the assault of their loved ones. However, as a prosecutorial matter, proving hate crimes is more difficult often than simply proving the crime, because at the end of the day, what you're trying to show is not merely that in this case Miller murdered three people, but that he was, what was in his mind? Why did he carry out those murders? And sometimes that's rather difficult to show. In his case, it probably wouldn't be. I mean, it's a fact that he yelled Heil Hitler immediately after the shooting, so that was televised by a local camera crew. In any case, I don't think in this case there'd make much difference one way or the other.
This is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio, and if you're just tuning in, my guest is Mark Potok, a senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center. I had not known until I did a little research that hate crime legislation dates back to the Civil Rights Act of 1871, when following the Civil War, during Reconstruction, racially motivated crimes in the South were committed by the Ku Klux Klan. The modern era for hate crime legislation seems to have begun, about 100 years later. The first penalty enhancement statute was passed in California in 1978. Since then, 45 states and the District of Columbia have statutes criminalizing various types of hate crimes. What is the argument for adding penalties to the punishments that already exist for murders, assaults, robberies, vandalism, and other crimes?
Well, that's a very good question, and oftentimes you will hear critics, particularly on the political right, saying, we're punishing thought. It's un-American. I would very much disagree with that. I mean, the logic of enhancing penalties for hate crimes as opposed to other crimes is a couple of things. One, the idea that there are more victims than the immediate people who are attacked. So if you, say, attack black family that has moved into a largely white neighborhood, say, or you plant a burning cross on the lawn of an interracial couple, those kinds of things do not merely attack the immediate victims. They make every other black person in that state or in that area who's living in white neighborhoods afraid. It makes every other interracial couple in the neighborhood afraid. They are being terrorized. So these are essentially acts of terrorism. They're designed not merely to intimidate and frighten and hurt the immediate victims, but they have the effect of really terrorizing a much larger community. The other, I think, important justification is the idea that hate crimes, unlike most other crimes, tend to split communities along pre-existing fault lines. In other words, you know, American communities in general do have problems with race relations and so on, and these crimes exacerbate those problems and really split entire communities in very devastating ways. You know, one other way of thinking about this is that we do, in fact, in American law, in many instances, punish people for motive, not merely for what they actually did. So, for instance, say a person is found on my porch, you know, trespassing on my land, having walked onto my lot, and he's now on the porch, and the cops come, and he's arrested. Well, you know, it would be one thing if what he was really doing was taking a shortcut across the corner lot in order to get home, you know, 3 minutes earlier. However, if the police found in his pocket a set of burglary tools, the charge would be entirely different. It would be attempted burglary because it would be clear by that evidence that his intention was not merely to walk across the corner of my lot. You know, in the same way, you might think about the way the murders of police officers are treated. If someone kills you or I walking down the streets, in most states, the killer might get, say, 15, 20 years, something like that. However, if you or I were a police officer and were killed in this very same circumstances, chances are excellent the person would get the death penalty. And that is because we as a society have decided that the police are the quote-unquote thin blue line. They are people who take risks every day in order to protect the rest of us, and we as a society have a very high interest in protecting those individuals.
Well, I'm sure some people might raise questions about having such very harsh penalties for police officers, but going back to your first point about how you can terrorize an entire community, I have no trouble believing that you can, but you could say that about crime in general. I mean, you get enough, you know, you had enough murders going on in a particular neighborhood, even if they weren't racially motivated, they would terrorize that neighborhood.
Well, in a sense, that's right. But it's that terror applies to everyone equally. And that's not true. If the murderer, the attacker, whatever it may be, is only going after, say, gay men. You know, it's typically a specific demographic that's being attacked and terrorized. So it seems to me a little more pointed and a little more threatening than simply, you know, you happen to live in a city that has a very high crime rate right now and it's not terribly safe out there.
What do you say to people who say, given the very large number of Americans incarcerated in our country, a greater percentage of the population serving time in prison than in any other country, why lock people up for even longer, particularly when penalties in this country are pretty stiff as is, and most people, when they do serve time, are serving longer sentences than in other countries?
Well, I think that's a legitimate argument to make. I would argue that in the case of young people, certainly first offenders with respect to hate crimes, it is a real mistake generally to send them to prison or even to jail, and the reason, well, especially prison. The reason is that our prison system is extremely racialized. And particularly younger people going into prisons often find it necessary to join racist prison gangs in order to protect themselves. So, you know, if you're a white kid going into prison, you may very well feel pressured and your fears would not be out of place to join a white prison gang so that you will not be, say, terrorized or raped or shaken down by black inmates. And the same is true for black kids going into the prison system. So, you know, for younger offenders, I think what often happens is we see these kids who are perhaps angry, maybe they're acting out with respect to problems in their own family and so on. You know, they may have some racist feelings, but they're not committed racists. Well, you know, when they come out of prison, sometimes they really are committed racists. You know, now they have racist tattoos all over their body. They've been schooled up in the ideology of, you know, why black people are our enemy and so on and so on. In the case of older people, you know, I think the argument you're making is perhaps better made. I think that, you know, you really can go back and forth about that. The reason, I think it's probably very doubtful that hate crime penalty enhancements really lower the level of crime. I think that very few people before they, you know, sock somebody in the face, really think about whether they're going to get 6 months or whether it's going to be 9 months. However, it's a way of society saying, sort of out loud, that this is important. These crimes are really destructive of our society, and we're paying attention. So in a sense, it's symbolic.
Well, a couple of questions. When you say it's a way of society saying out loud these crimes are important, does it then, if there's no deterrent value, does it then simply become an expression of liberal self-righteousness?
One could argue about that, and I don't know that they have no deterrent value. I know there are people who do work similar to what I do, who are in the kind of anti-hate business, who believe that they really are effective. I'm not sure there's ever really been a serious study, any kind of scholarly study, that has shown it to be one way or the other. It has really proven the case one way or the other. I guess I just have to leave it there. I'm really not sure.
You mentioned how you think it would be a mistake to lock a young person up for a crime motivated by some kind of animus against a particular group. In my mind, I have this idea of the common person committing a hate crime as being young. But is that a misconception on my part?
No, it's true. It is the same group of young men that commit most crimes in general. I don't know the precise ages, but, you know, like 14 to 24, that range. You know, it's typically men, it's typically young men. But that's no more or less true for hate crimes than it is for any other kind of crime, you know, barring a few special categories like financial crimes.
Is there any concern that penalty enhancements for hate crimes creates a backlash against the people they are intended to protect? That people may perceive that some people get special treatment under the law, that we aren't all equal, and that some people are a lot more equal than others?
Well, I haven't heard that argument much made in the political mainstream. However, it is commonly made on the far right, among the white supremacist groups, who really go on quite a bit along just those lines, that, you know, white people are the real victims. The politically correct have kind of seized control of the society, and they, meaning Aryans, as they would call themselves, are the real victims, are the people who are really being discriminated against.
I know that the Matthew Shepard Act made sexual identity a protected category. Is gender a protected category, given that crimes against women are certainly very common?
Under the Matthew Shepard Act, yes, but under very few other state statutes. It's a dicey proposition because once you head down that road, it is possible, at least theoretically it seems to me, to say that, say, every sexual assault of a woman is a hate crime. And I think at that point, you know, we're beginning to lose the meaning of what the writers of these laws had in their heads at the beginning. In any case, I don't think there have been very, very rare prosecutions of that sort.
And in terms of prosecuting crimes as hate crimes, is the bar for evidence pretty high, or is anybody who attacks a member of a certain group liable to be suspected of committing a hate crime?
Oh, I don't think that's true. I think that these are very tough cases to make. There's a huge amount of interracial crime, obviously, in the country, and most of it is not quote-unquote hate crime. Obviously things differ from state to state and jurisdiction to jurisdiction in terms of how cases are tried. But I think it's tough, and I think prosecutors shy away, as a general matter, from hate crime prosecutions simply because it adds a whole dimension of proof that is tough to get to, the idea of, you know, what was in this person's mind. Sometimes the cases are incredibly simple. I mean, the classic hate crime is, you know, the man who walks into a bar and says to the person on the stool next to him, starts to talk about how he hates, say, black people, and then walks out of that bar, and the first black person who walks by is murdered by this guy, you know, someone, a complete stranger killing. I mean, that's quite an obvious case. But usually, from a legal point of view, the facts are not so clean. It's not so easy. So I think that is why, very often, crimes that probably are hate crimes are not, in fact, prosecuted that way. Another very good example is, for instance, there have been an awful lot of armed robberies of undocumented Latino immigrants. And I've seen several instances in which this argument is played out. You know, are they being attacked and terrorized because the robbers look down on, hate, despise Latinos? Or is it simply that they're undocumented and they're vastly less likely to go to the police and get you in trouble?
The Southern Poverty Law Center was founded in 1971. How has the work of the center changed, and how have hate groups changed, if at all, since the senator began monitoring them? Have you seen new types of groups spring up?
Well, first to the first question, I mean, we our work early on was, the very first work of the center was just kind of classic civil rights law firm work. We worked on cases having to do with, say, voter dilution, voting rights cases with a racial angle, the kinds of things that many other people were doing. In the early 80s, Morris Dees, the co-founder of the center, brought our first civil suit against a Klan group, and that really was, legally speaking, a genuinely pioneering case. The idea of suing these groups and their leaders for the actions of their members, even when the leaders did not know in advance what the members were going to do, was quite novel. So that became certainly what the center was most famous for. Back then, in the 70s, early 80s, this is a very small operation. There were probably four or five lawyers and a few other people. Today we're almost 250 people, and the work has expanded very greatly. In my own department, we cover all kinds of hate groups, as you talked about at the very beginning of the show. We also have a very large teaching tolerance department, which works with schools all over the country to do just what the name suggests. These are K-12 schools. And our legal department is into all kinds of different issues now. We're doing a lot of work on having to do with immigration, with exploitation of foreign workers in this country, with kids, particularly in deep South schools, particularly black kids, being very quickly put into prison for minor offenses and that kind of thing. So the work has very much expanded in a number of different directions. How have the groups changed? Well, one thing that did not exist at the time the center began were the so-called militia groups. The groups call themselves patriot groups. And this whole world of groups that believes the federal government is the real enemy, that the federal government is secretly conspiring to kind of enslave the American people and destroy their liberties and force us into a one-world government, so-called, the so-called New World Order, that's all fairly new. The roots of those groups go back into the 70s and 60s, but the actual militia movement really didn't appear until the 90s.
And
then we have all these new kinds of groups, like anti-Muslim groups, are a fairly new phenomenon in the last 10 years or so.
Before we close, could you say just a little bit about the Sovereign Citizens Movement, which is a subset of these anti-government groups that you've spoken of? I was very interested to read about them and knew nothing about them.
Well, it's a very bizarre movement. As you say, it's a subset of the Patriot Movement. These are people specifically who believe that the federal government has no authority over them in terms of criminal or tax laws. They typically don't believe that they have to pay any taxes. They typically believe that the government has no right to regulate their passage on the roads. In other words, no government can demand driver's licenses or auto insurance or car registrations and so on. They also engage in all kinds of very strange filings in court, filings that have no basis in the real legal system, but which have the effects of gumming up the courts. The whole thing, when you really get into the incredibly convoluted theories that sovereign citizens have, would be almost funny because they're so ridiculous, some of their theories about the government, were it not for the fact that a hefty number of sovereign citizens have engaged in really serious criminal violence. Just one case I think of immediately is May 20th of 2010, when a sovereign citizen father and son were pulled over in West Memphis, Arkansas by police doing a routine stop on the interstate there. These guys got out of their van. They handed what was supposedly their car registration to the officers, but was in fact this strange document filled with sovereign citizens language that the cops just couldn't understand. You can actually see them on the dash cam looking at this and looking puzzled. And at that very moment, these two men, well, actually the son jumps out of the car that's being stopped with an AK-47 and murders the two officers. We've seen quite a number of those killings of law officers by sovereign citizens. That is without a doubt why the FBI has described the sovereign citizen movement as a domestic terrorist movement.
Mark, before we close, is there a website that you'd like to give for the Southern Poverty Law Center? If people have questions, is there
sure.
any
I,
place
people are
should...
welcome to look at our website. We have two things that may interest people. We have about 15 years of archives of investigative stories that have been published in the magazine I edit, the Intelligence Report. And we also have a map, an interactive hate group map, which I think is of very high interest to many people. You can click on your state and see what are the active groups in your state, where are they located, what are their names, what type of groups they are, and that sort of thing. The website is www.splcenter.org, splcenter.org.
Mark, thank you so much for talking to us about the Southern Poverty Law Center.
A real pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Bye-bye.
You work hard, and you have the right to be paid every cent of the money you earn. Our laws protect you, whether you're documented or not. Here are some of the ways to protect your wages. Write down the name of your employer, their address, and telephone number. Also, every day you work, write down the times and number of hours you are on the job. This is very important. The U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division will talk to you in confidence, strictly in confidence. And the call is free. If you have a problem or a question, call 1-866-487-9243. That's 1-866-4-US-WAGE. We can help.
The American way for workers everywhere. You got rights. We can help.
A message from the U.S. Department of Labor.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Speaking at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy, this is Ethan Nadelman, the Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance.
The United States is extraordinary in one terrible regard, which is that we have less than 5% of the world's population, but almost 25% of the world's incarcerated population. Right? We have the highest per capita incarceration in the world, the highest per capita incarceration rate of any democratic society in history, the rate at which we lack up black people in this country. It makes the Soviet gulags look like child's play in comparison, and apartheid South Africa like nothing in comparison as well. But we become dependent upon the criminal justice system as a form of political and cultural crutch that has had devastating consequences in this country. That's the first thing. And part of what drives me, the number one thing that drives me, is just a sense of shame as an American that our country should hold that distinction. That seems wrong. The second thing I just want to say is that when it comes to the global war on drugs, we have been the driving force for almost a century, right? We have been the champion. We have shaped the global conventions. We have pushed through bilateral and multilateral relationships for other countries to follow in our footsteps. The number of countries that decided to criminalize marijuana decades ago without ever having heard of marijuana. U.S. wants it, we'll do it. And without realizing the consequences that would follow, our Federal Drug Enforcement Administration, the first global police force, we have played a major proactive role in that regard in ways that's beginning to change. But it's important to understand that global role there. Third thing, and this is the one which I know none of you are going to believe me with, but I just got to say it, that there is no real solid basis in science, in medicine, in ethics, or even in the Bible for that matter, for distinguishing between alcohol or tobacco on the one hand and marijuana, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine on the other. There is no basis in medical science, you name it, for just saying that if you're, God forbid, a parent with two kids who are an addict and one's addicted to booze and one's addicted to heroin, that this one's going to be dealt with fundamentally different than that one, even though any physician in the world will tell you that heroin in its pure form is dramatically less dangerous to the body than is the alcohol. There is no basis. There was no point 100 years ago where some wise National Academy of Science looked at all the drugs and said, well, we got to criminalize those ones, but not those ones. What determines why some drugs are legal and others not has almost nothing to do with the relative risks or dangers of those substances, and almost everything to do with who uses and who is perceived to use those substances.
You can hear the full speech with Ethan Nadelman of the Drug Policy on our website, the most recent Cultural Baggage program, DeanBeckerDrugTruth.net.
Ready? One, two, three. Here in my prime, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Liam, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musicale.
Myself how to understand, gonna make myself a better.